With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to be talking about the Austrian economist Friedrich Hayek. One of the reasons, well, the chief reason to talk about Hayek, really, is that the arguments that he has proposed and throughout his career really shape the economic world around us and have done so since from the 1970s onwards. He's something of an enigmatic character to most people, and his name probably means very little to the majority of people who are affected by the ideas that he proposed. But Hayek has been is one of the kind of the chief economic and ideological figures of the 20th century, and every major world economy now, with perhaps the exception of North Korea, but you can't really describe that as a major world economy anyway, has been fundamentally shaped by Hayek's classic liberal economic stance. For those of you who aren't economists, I'm just going to talk a little bit about some of the ideas that constitute classical economics. The classical economics, the term classical normally predates back to Rome and Greece. Now, we're not talking about that. Classical economics is really the kind of the school of economics that sort of emerged during the very beginnings of industrialized and mercantile society in Europe in the 18th century, perhaps just the end of the 17th, beginning of the 18th century. During the Enlightenment, it's an idea that dates back to really a handful of thinkers. Most influential to being Adam Smith and David Ricardo. And the third, and slightly less well-known, Thomas Malthus, who is obviously known for his understanding of things like populations, demographics, and famines. In 1776, Adam Smith, a Scottish economist, wrote The Wealth of Nations, in which he was attempting to write a philosophical work that helped us to understand this new world of markets in which we were living and how markets could best be used to distribute in a utilitarian way the greatest good to the greatest number. And the argument that he set forth was this. So marketplace was a place where consumers and producers met, and that producers would seek to maximise profit, whereas consumers would seek to maximise both utility and value. And thus, from this interaction, competition would emerge, and competition was perhaps the best thing for producing this utilitarian result, equity for all. The best products at the best prices would be created, and that labour, people, the amount that people charge for their wages, would also be regulated in this fashion, that better workers would be able to charge more, and the workers in general would have to compete in order to provide their labour on the marketplace. This, combined with the ability of countries to diversify and specialise in certain products and services and raw materials over others, would mean that eventually all countries would be able to trade on their comparative advantages. One country would have specialise in one commodity, another in a different one, and they would be able eventually to have a means of equitable exchange. Now, this model of the economy required on a notion that Smith put forward, and he actually said this, by the way, in the world can never exist, but it's a nice idea. It was of this idea of perfect information, that for an individual in a marketplace to be able to maximise utility and value and not wind up ultimately being, for want of a better word, exploited by the manufacturer, maker or seller, one needed to have perfect information to know all one's options and to be able to have a fully rational judgment about the right thing to purchase. We live in a world where advertising, for example, makes the notion of perfect information pretty much negligible. Smithian premise was that for a perfect economy to operate, nobody would have a monopoly of market power over anybody else. And Smith fully accepted that this was unlikely to ever occur. The people who now embrace Adam Smith's notions that very often tend to kind of ignore that one little bit of it. So these were the classical economic precepts that this is ideally how a market society should work. And you can't blame Adam Smith really for coming up with this very simplistic notion, because here he is right at the very beginnings of the modern capitalist world and trying to work out in an armchair kind of way how it all worked and how it was all happening and why it was happening as it did. It would be like somebody today trying to, without any technical knowledge, really work out what the internet was. You know, the internet is a kind of a modern phenomenon of equivalent complexity and novelty, I guess. Anyway, moving on to Friedrich Hayek. By the time that Friedrich Hayek was writing, from the 1930s onwards, the industrialised Western world had well over a century of experience of the workings and the failings of markets, and the idea that classical economics really could provide solutions was something of a very antiquated and backward idea. Not only had there been, throughout the 19th century, the equivalent of one major economic slump nearly every decade, there had been, obviously, throughout the 1930s, the Great Depression. The idea, particularly after World War II, that classical economics was of any use at all, really, without the intervention of the state in some major way to correct flaws within the market, was really only held on kind of remote fringes of political and economic and philosophical respectability. By the time you get to the mid-1950s, under the era of Harold Macmillan, you only have a handful of quite extreme figures within the Conservative Party, led by Enoch Powell, who really believe in unfettered free market capitalism. However, by the 1970s, people like Hayek were being widely read within the Conservative Party in Britain and within both the Republican and Democrat parties in America, and being quoted and being resurrected. And Hayek's famous book, The Road to Serfdom, which I'll talk about more in just a moment, was being brought back into circulation in sort of academic and political circles. So the question is, in such a short space of time, in a couple of decades between the 1950s and the 1970s, what changed? Now, here is where it gets interesting. Our economic thinking from the 1970s onwards has been dominated by these notions of modernisation. Everyone from Margaret Thatcher to Tony Blair has gone on about modernising the unions, modernising the public sector, modernising this, that and the other. However, the ideas that they were proposing in to bring about these modernisations are actually very antiquated, very old ideas. They are ideas that were really the stuff of kind of Gladstonian liberalism and High Toryism of the 1870s and 80s. And not only were they quite old-fashioned views in general terms, they had been incubated in the most unlikely of places. Post-war Vienna, after the defeat of the Habsburg Empire in 1918. Five intellectuals from post-war Vienna, Ludwig von Mises, Joseph Schumpeter, Karl Popper, Peter Drucker and Friedrich Hayek, sought to create an explanation as to why liberal Austria that existed, the small Austrian Republic that existed after 1918, collapsed first to a kind of a brief socialist experiment and then later to kind of nationalist, fascist and then Nazi tyranny by the late 1930s. And their arguments were, in essence, that it had begun with the socialist government. All men, as intellectuals, had fled into exile when the fascism of Chancellor Dollfuss took power. And they were typical of these kind of Central European emigres who found solace in Western university departments in Britain and America. And the answer they proposed to the question of how Nazism or fascism and then German Nazism had taken over in Austria was that it was really the fault of the socialist, the original socialist states' centralised planning and their kind of totalitarian, in their view, control over the economy. That this had had a profound effect, not just on the economics of Austria, but as a result on the politics of Austria too. There had been, as a result of this intervention in this, of the state into the lives of individuals, a reaction against socialism which resulted, in their eyes, in fascism. The failure of the left in the eyes of Hayek and his contemporaries was that the left, influenced by Marxism, believed that they had seen a dialectic, this pattern in history. They believed they had understood the process by which historical change came about and how we went from one phase of history to another and class struggle and revolution and the Marxist model of history and all that. And that they, as a result, had faith in the rational powers of man, the ability of men to understand their exploitation and to overthrow capitalism, embrace socialism and create these wonderful utopias that are supposedly going to come about. And in the failure that they that the left indulged in, as far as Hayek was concerned, was being wrong, in that people were not rational in this way and were not... Man is not, in essence, good.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
And the failure of the socialist experiment in Austria led the door open to fascism. Now, this theory, I'm not saying it's particularly sound. I think there are an awful lot of problems with it. But it was immensely popular, particularly when it was espoused by Hayek in his book The Road to Serfdom. And Hayek argued that really the problem of the individual in the 20th century is the expansion and the growth of the state in this slightly amorphous fashion. And as the state grows, the individual atrophies. The state takes on more responsibility, the individual surrenders those, and instead of this being a kind of a cosy social democracy where people have free healthcare and things like that, it leads to a kind of enslavement of the individual. Liberty, in Hayek's view, personal liberty, civil rights, political freedoms, religious freedoms, you name it, could only be obtained by keeping the state at bay, particularly keeping the state out of economic life. The moment the state starts to get in there, according to Hayek, it starts to get into jam up the delicate workings of the market, and economic crisis precipitates political crisis, which precipitates the threat of some kind of totalitarianism. When the political classes are held at bay, even the well-intentioned ones that hope to affect the quality of people's lives for the better, you safeguard freedom, not from those people particularly, not from the democratic politicians who are trying to intervene to improve things, but you save freedom from the fascists or the communists who will take over when the democrats have failed. Now, if you think about it, every intellectual of the post-war era, people like Hannah Arendt or Albert Camus, were chiefly interested in this one question: what had happened between 1918 and 1939 to make a Second World War happen? What had happened to make Nazism? What had happened to enable the Holocaust to occur? This was the pivotal intellectual question of the day, really, until probably the end of the Cold War. And so you can hardly blame Hayek, really, for musing over this one. And his perspective was perhaps slightly tainted in a way by being so close to the situation and being, in many ways, a victim of the Nazis, having to flee his native Austria. Men like John Maynard Keynes, who had completely different views to Hayek and who believed, really, that the state had a role, believed that the crises of the 1930s could greatly have been avoided had democratic states taken more of a direct role in ameliorating the extremes of the Great Depression and getting involved and creating job creation schemes and that kind of thing. That it's the poor, the jobless, the desperate that tend to flock to fascism or communism or whatever extreme you care to mention. When Hayek wrote The Road to Serfdom in 1944, the political winds were changing in Britain. You'd had things like the Beveridge Report, where the basis of the welfare state was laid in clear point-by-point analysis, the things that would be needed after the war to create a modern social democracy. And Beveridge identified the five evils as of squalor, ignorance, want, idleness and disease, and from this really our National Health Service and our comprehensive education system and social security spring from. And there was a shift really in the population throughout the war to embrace not only notions of social democracy that had not been widespread prior to that, but also an acceptance that the state had a crucial role to play, and that state intervention, state planning, nationalisation and all of this, a much, much expanded state in the second half of the 20th century, would help to build the Britain that the majority of people throughout World War II had wanted to see. Here's what Hayek had to say on the subject. He said, "No description in general terms can give an adequate idea of the similarity of much of current English political literature to the works which destroyed the belief in Western civilization in Germany and created the state of mind in which Nazism could become successful." So he was saying there that the winds of change that were blowing through Britain in the last year or two of the war that result in the Labour government of 1945, these kinds of ideas were likely to result in a British Nazism. And obviously you have the rather ludicrous claims by Winston Churchill in the 1945 general election that Labour would need some kind of Gestapo in order to police its new welfare state. Things which were kind of largely laughed off by the British population as they voted for Labour in record numbers in 1945. The idea of applying directly this model, this Austrian model, to any democratic nation that sought to expand state welfare was seen as patently ludicrous, and for much of the post-war era was laughed off and treated as really kind of on the very edges of academic and political and economic respectability. There was an assumption by Hayek that Sweden would follow the same model, and that Sweden's high degree of state spending, free education and healthcare and that sort of thing, would also precipitate some kind of Nazism. Fortunately for Hayek, the welfare state that he had long been very sceptical about and suspicious of was capable of functioning in an optimal manner during the kind of the mid-boom era of from the mid-1950s through to the mid-1970s. But when the global boom that had existed in the mid-20th century after the Second World War started to tail off and lead into a series of recessions really in the 70s, 80s and 90s, Hayek was able to be a bit more jubilant because he could then demonstrate that the welfare state had not produced the results that it was claimed to. What it doesn't produce in the Hayek synthesis of things, what it doesn't produce obviously is totalitarianism. But as Hayek, now quite late in his life, was popularised once again by the new right, by the new right in the Conservative Party, the Thatcherites, people who were looking in the 1970s to embrace this idea of neoliberalism, or neoclassicism in economics, Hayek starts to lose control of his own argument. And the likes of Sir Keith Joseph, Margaret Thatcher, Norman Tebbit in Britain, and their fellow travellers in America begin to appropriate elements of Hayek's argument. You'll notice that in none of the Conservative Party's literature from the time or Margaret Thatcher's speeches or anything is there a suggestion that fascism might break out in Britain. This would have been patently ludicrous. But elements of Hayek, whom she read in the 1970s religiously, along with the various think tanks, the Institute for Economic Affairs and the Centre for Policy Studies, which are the two key Thatcherite think tanks, the road to serfdom was a great way for Margaret Thatcher to appropriate Hayekian ideas into her new economic brand of neoliberalism, which was to become Thatcherism, which had an emphasis on the reduction of trade union power, shrinking in the role of the state, control of the money supply using the economic principles of monetarism, which were the brainchild really of Milton Friedman, about whom we'll hopefully talk another time, and the introduction of greater flexibility into the labour market to hopefully cure Britain from the twin problems it had in the 1970s of high unemployment and high inflation. In all of this, Hayek's kind of one central principle tends to get lost, and maybe this is a good thing. Maybe this is a good thing because ultimately it appears to be, to some level, largely unworkable. Hayek's notion really was that state planning, anything centralised, has to result in some kind of dictatorship, that the market may not function perfectly all the time, but at least it functions freely. The market doesn't require any kind of coercion. Again, this is a notion that perhaps needs to be challenged as well, in that there are numerous examples we can point to where free markets are created using state coercion. That's kind of another story anyway. I think the ultimate expression of the usage of the likes of Hayek is the 2008 crash, born of radical deregulation and the faith, not just amongst the political and the economic classes, but by and large amongst the general public in the Western world, that deregulated capitalism can work, can deliver the goods that other economic systems have failed to do in the past. And by faith, we invest in a kind of an invisible system of workings which we cannot quantify or put a face to. An immense degree of trust that was really largely unconditional up until about 2008. For obvious reasons, it's tailed off in recent years. But the reasons why we put our faith in neoliberal capitalism, or why we previously put our faith in neoliberal capitalism, are far, far divorced from the original arguments of Hayek that it was our only safeguard, really, against the emergence of dictatorship. And now it would appear that really even that is not something that holds true in the 21st century. Anyway, I hope you found this interesting and useful today, and we'll be coming back at you in in the next couple of days with the Explaining History Review podcast. We're running a little bit late this month, but mercifully Penguin Books have decided to come to our rescue with some great new titles to review in September. Look forward to catching you again on the next Explaining History podcast. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.